Thank you for joining us at the i3 Detroit Hour. Coming up, Nick Britsky invites a few friends of i3 Detroit for a special roundtable discussion of current events in U.S. technology and media. Our program following the Turbo Trojans' first robotics team will resume next month. All music we use in our program was found online under the Creative Commons license. To learn more about the music used in our program, please email us at contact@i3detroit.com. Thank you, and please enjoy the show. This is i3 Detroit.
And a 1, 2, 3, 4.
I believe if I buy the device, I own the device. And if I want to, you know, hack it to do something different with it than it was intended to, I should have that right.
Funding has been obtained for a proposed RoboCop statue to be built in downtown Detroit. Seriously. Also, the Pentagon is fishing for good guy hackers with white cowboy hats. These hacker heroes are needed to secure American data systems from an increasing tide of hostile attacks. And in other news, Watson, the famous IBM computer contestant on Jeopardy, soundly beats out his human opponents in the first round. I, for one, welcome our new computer overlords. Jailbreaking your mobile phone, the new Interactive Entertainment Caucus in the House of Representatives, and more. Up next on the i3 Detroit Hour.
All right, everyone, welcome to another hour of i3 Detroit Masterpiece. This is a couple people from the space. We have Nick Britsky here, as well as Ross Smith, Russ Wolf.
Hey, everybody.
That was Ross Smith, and then we have Russ Wolf.
Hello, everyone.
And we have Lish Dorsett.
Hello.
So, a number of hacker-related, technology-related, hackerspace-related news has happened this week. I think the one that's on everybody's mind, just because it was funded today through Kickstarter, was the Detroit RoboCop statue. So the Free Press reported today that sci-fi fans rejoice. The statue raised the $50,000 it needed to be constructed in downtown Detroit. Ross, why don't you give us a little background on this? What have you heard about this?
It's really phenomenal. As I understand it, there were suggestions being solicited by, you know, the office of Detroit Mayor Bing for the erection of some kind of statue in downtown Detroit. And RoboCop, of course, came up at some point. Some smartass decided to put that in the suggestion box. And the official Twitter feed from Mayor Bing said, essentially, thank you for the suggestion, but no, we're not going to consider pursuing a RoboCop statue. And in the way that these things tend to get out of control, someone said, what a fantastic idea. And they put out a bucket and started a Kickstarter and said, let's raise $50,000 and bring RoboCop to downtown Detroit. And 4 days later, it's fully satisfied. It's just, it blows me away.
You know, Russ and I were actually heading downtown Detroit this evening, and we were talking about that, some of the hurdles they might have. Russ, what were you saying that might be a big problem for them?
Well, I think the biggest hurdle is getting the rights, since it's going to be publicly displayed, to actually have a RoboCop statue in the city of Detroit. Even though the land is being donated for it to be put on, I still would imagine that somebody out there owns the rights to the design of the RoboCop character, and they're going to have those, I guess, approval to be able to do that. But the interesting thing is that somebody actually pledged, what, $25,000 towards this, and it would be very interesting if that was actually maybe the owner or the movie studio backing this so that they can bring back RoboCop, since the movie industry loves to do these days, bringing back old movies and redoing them.
I mean, yeah. To your point, Russ, it was one single person donated $25,000 from San Francisco, as rumor has it. And yeah, it would be intriguing to know who exactly that was, if they're related to the story or the movie business. The licensing, yeah, I mean, if RoboCop's based on a comic book, or if we're doing a statue based off the movie version and that artist's rendering of RoboCop in the movie, it could get really complex really fast, even if, you know, several artists just have the cash in hands to build the structure.
Yeah, so now, not to go without any controversy, you know, RoboCop obviously depicted Detroit as a very rough and tumble time, very lawless. You know, RoboCop was actually kind of invented to, you know, for low budgets when, you know, they were cutting back on police officers and to kind of, you know, do more with less. You know, Lish, you didn't seem to totally be on board with the statue. What are some of your thoughts of why you think it's a bad idea to make the statue?
Well, let's just all remember the fact that RoboCop wasn't actually shot in Michigan.
Dallas, I believe.
Yes. So it's a Texas production. So if y'all don't want to mess with Texas, I mean, go ahead and support the statue. But I just come from the background of there are a lot of ways to get involved in the community, and the $10 that you contributed to the RoboCop Fund could have easily been donated to Gleaners Food Bank, could have been donated to the Humane Society. I mean, like, ask a lot of people who are just very passionate about the city, and I'm sure they could give you a number of organizations that would have very happily taken the donation. I feel like there's just so much media attention on Detroit right now that this is just like another kind of gimmicky thing that's got, you know, a New York Times blog written all over it for a bunch of hipsters to kind of have wet dreams about. So that's just my quick take on it and end rant.
Now, was I the only one to sponsor the Kickstarter project?
I did
on this call?
Yes, on this call. Did you?
You know, I was thinking about it, but it was over before I had a chance to get out my wallet.
Okay.
Thanks, Ross.
So basically, initially, I had seen it because I love T-shirts. Lish can obviously attest to the mass number of T-shirts that I have. And
it's true. He likes them a lot.
I'd love to get cool T-shirts from Threadless, Cafe Press, all that stuff. So I was really interested to get a T-shirt, really just because, you know, I sponsored the RoboCop statue and all I got was this crappy T-shirt. That was kind of what I was interested in. Now, there are certainly people that are, you know, very passionate about this. I've had some debates with people on Facebook. I know that Bethany from Omnicore Detroit, who's a hackerspace in Detroit, that has a lot more kind of writing on this because Omnicore Detroit actually takes their name from RoboCop. And, I mean, what a cool tie-in to be in a hackerspace in Detroit that has the statue of RoboCop. But it is very interesting that a lot of people are very passionate about not wanting this kind of in their backyard.
Yeah, I can sympathize with those people. I agree with Lish to a degree that this is something that raises a whole lot of sort of image mongering and publicity, but it doesn't do substantive good for the suffering that's in the city and around the city. But on the flip side, you know, when you're not in Detroit, you're not experiencing it. There is something to be said about amending an image that we've got. You know, the thing that always riles me up is when I see some kind of article in the New York Times, you know, specifically talking about the arts culture and Maker Faire and things like that, but their leading image of Detroit is like this hellhole of a concrete, you know, it looks like a bomb was dropped in the middle of a highway cloverleaf or something like that, and they say, Detroit, you know, growth among the ruins. Like, anything to just sort of turn that image on its ear or show it to be ridiculous, I kind of appreciate. And I think exaggerating that to the point of ridiculousness with a RoboCop statue might be what it takes to put us image-wise over the edge so that Detroit can at least be seen as something other than, you know. I mean, do you think it makes it worse to put RoboCop up, or does it just sort of deflate the ridiculousness of saying that Detroit is a wasteland? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, you know, and I guess my worry with it is I'm not for it or against it. I'm very neutral on it. People want to put their money where they want to put their money. Great. Cool. I think it's a cool concept. My concern, though, is with the spotlight that Detroit has been put in, is, and it's been referred to this sometimes, is that we're kind of lawless if you go down to Detroit. It's just every man for themselves. It's kind of a frenzy. And I feel like the RoboCop statue in some people's mind kind of is saying that, because, you know, the whole scenario with RoboCop, and he was kind of put into a lawless city. And I feel like some people, the people that are strongly against it, feel like that's what it's portraying, saying we need a RoboCop type thing because it is lawless here in Detroit, where there's obviously the other side, as Nick described, where it could be looked at as a very positive thing, kind of a new beginning for Detroit. So it'll be interesting to see how the city actually reacts to this, I think, because what are the rules and regulations for putting up a statue like that, even on private land? You know, are there height restrictions that the city, will they battle this in any format?
Well, as far as restrictions go on private land, I have a statue of myself in the backyard. It's about 20 feet tall, and I haven't had any problems with it yet, so.
Actually, it's a poop moth. It's very tall.
Oh,
it breathes fire. It has enormous wings. I believe you've got a secret base somewhere inside of it, right?
Oh, you've seen it. Okay.
But I think his pants are unbuttoned, and he's showing his little heart boxers.
Oh, boy. Total inside jokes. All right, let's move on. So one of the other things that happened this week, last week, was the Pentagon announcing that they're going to really up their cyber defense program and actually call to local hackers to get them involved in kind of their government and almost using the white hats to help fight the black hats. What have you guys heard about this? Have you heard anything about this? What are your thoughts?
I've heard of these kind of call for hacker programs from the Pentagon before, and I always thought they were pretty cool and smart in the sense that it's fight fire with fire. My question, I guess, for the whole purpose of the program is, do you think you've just got the people, you've got the talent by sheer numbers to overcome the people who might be coming at the Pentagon? If you've got, you know, 50 or 100 foreign hackers for every one or two domestic hackers stepping up to this cause, you know, it may be helping, but is it helping enough, you know?
Russell,
I've heard much about this one. I've heard others in the past. I know DARPA has really put out a big program over the last year, hiring hackers to work on projects for them. And I know they actually, I did some reading a while back, a hacker known as Mudge, which was back from what they consider the original hackerspace, the Loft in Boston. He was actually one of the guys who was originally part of that and started it. And last year, DARPA actually hired him to kind of deal with cybersecurity attacks and stuff, which is just an interesting take of bringing someone of that caliber on who at one time was kind of considered to be on the other side of the law. I don't know a whole lot about him, so I can't speak about the past, but it is interesting that they're finally starting to see the value in the knowledge that hackers can bring instead of just looking at them as the media has portrayed them as, you know, the guys who sit behind computers and steal credit card theft and other things. They're finally starting to see the value in the knowledge and the skill sets that we have.
Very interesting. You know what? I'm curious if some of the traditional kind of hackerspaces that you and I know and are kind of friends with will engage in some of this. I feel like certainly like Pumping Station 1 has a lot more kind of the coder types. And I know that I3 has a couple in the wings, but I'm wondering if we have the talent to go after something like this.
I think we certainly have individuals with the background in computer science, you know, in systems administration and info security. I wonder, too, how many of the hackers that this program is soliciting are specifically people who have, you know, for realsies, if I may use an internet neologism, created viruses, you know, and spread them on systems and, like, tried to, like, say, you know, push over a bank website or something. I don't know, you know, what sort of way you could express that, but people who have really tried to crack into and take advantage of and exploit security systems. I don't know how many of those you can really find in a hackerspace, but perhaps we can.
I think there's definitely, from my reading and learning more about the different hackerspaces out there, there is a big group of security hackers. I mean, you know, you look at the whole DEF CON conference out in Las Vegas every year. It's one of the largest security hacking conferences. And I do think there's a lot of hackerspaces that definitely focus on that, as well as within, you know, the hackerspace community now. They've created the Angora network, which was, you know, developed by a couple different spaces and people working together that hackerspaces can become a part of, which creates a private network with security gear on there for security hacking to take place in a safe environment for people to learn, people to practice those type of skills.
That's very cool. What's that called again? The Angora network?
That is correct. You essentially put in a router in your network at your local hackerspace. There's settings that got to be set up to it and create you on this Angora network. And I know, I forget the name of the company, but I think it was last year or year and a half ago to 2 years, maybe, at the DEF CON conference, a security hardware company actually donated hardware to, I know, PS1, the Computer Congress in, I think, Oklahoma. Anyways, so there's like three spaces that all got donated gear to kind of build this network and provide it, because they said, well, if anyone's going to break this stuff and find loopholes in our
product, these are going to be the type of guys. So they essentially sponsored and kind of funded this to a degree.
Yeah, great idea. And I, very much in line, it sounds like, with what the Pentagon is doing, right, where they say, all right, you know, we're just going to cut you loose and, you know, try it out on the real thing. And if anyone's going to find a weakness or point it out to us, it's going to be the people who really would want to knock it over. So.
Correct.
I think it's very interesting. We'll keep kind of our ears out if we hear any people that are doing it, because it actually really cool to interview some people that have been kind of working with them and see what their thoughts are. I know way back in the day, my dad actually went to school to be an FBI agent. And, you know, kind of when he had his interview and when he started going through all the paperwork, he just like didn't like the organization, didn't like all the bureaucracy, and it just wasn't something that he pursued, just kind of working through all the government red tape and not. So I'm wondering how many of kind of your traditional hackers will kind of put up with some of that, you know, with the government, or if the government will be lenient with them.
Hopefully they're a little bit more lenient in the aspect of, I think by doing this, it's opening up a new market. You know, you can look at security hackers as makers, as creators. And I think what this is starting to do is actually open up a new potential to say, hey, you know, people with these skills are wanted or needed, even in such a role as a government role. And where our government is starting to see that, because you think about it, 10 years ago, you don't hear about these kind of things, of them taking the hacker and hiring them. And so I think it is opening up a new category and taking. Part of it is a generational change, I think. We have now in our generation more younger people that grew up in the computer world that have these type of skills, and you're just starting to see them, our government and even corporations actually embrace that skill set.
I think it's very cool. Well, let's move on. One of the big talking points for this week was man versus machine on Jeopardy. For the first time, over a course of different competitions, but the computer Watson took on two of the biggest competitors, the biggest winners on Jeopardy, and actually won. So did anyone actually watch this in the group?
I did not.
No, because I thought it was about glitter.
Why did you think it was about glitter?
It was a massive letdown. I have no interest in that.
It involved robots, so she must have tuned it out.
Pretty much.
Oh, boy.
I want to catch the episode. I want to go back and find some way and watch it, because it's just amazing the margin by which this computer beat its human competitors. As far as dollar winnings, I think Watson took home something like three times the amount of money as the second place candidate. You know, when you just use that as your metric for performance, it's like, wow, you know, machines are really on the rise. First you've got RoboCop, and now you've got, you know, Watson, and that's, you know, long since Big Blue and all that good stuff.
So we're reading an article from Wall Street Journal, actually said that Watson won $77,147. The next closest winner was Ken Jennings, who made a big splash, you know, a couple years ago, and he had $24,000. So he had, you know, less than a third of the dollars that Watson won, and then right behind him was Brad Rutter, whatever rock he crawled from under, with $21,600.
Don't be mean.
Do you know who Brad Rutter is?
No, but his mom's listening and he's pissed. She's pissed.
So
please think of the mothers.
Please, please do. You know, this comes from a long line of kind of robots versus man, you know, going back to the days of Garry Kasparov, you know, going against Deep Blue. You know, do we think this is going to happen more and more? I mean, robots are quote unquote replacing people on factory floors. Are they going to start, you know, winning our game shows and stealing our girlfriends?
Wow, no, I never thought of it that way. Yeah, robots replacing jobs and sort of taking money away from the average worker. Well, that's one way of taking your money, but they could also go on your game shows and win your contests as well. You know, play the odds, do the lottery, who knows? You know, machines can get rich all sorts of ways. I don't know, I've always taken the perspective that technology creates jobs. You know, there's this certain, you know, you could call it a Luddite perspective, where if you've got a factory job and it's replaced by a robot, then yes, there's some loss of employment there, but at the same time, lots of jobs are created of a different type for maintaining that machinery, for engineering it, for handling the product after the fact. And I think when you just look at the grand chart of, you know, countries that are highly developed and have a high degree of technological infrastructure, they have tons of jobs. There's tons of employment. And so I think this bodes generally good things. Although the fact that a machine can answer verbal questions in context like this terrifies me.
You should be very terrified. I've heard a rumor on the internet that robots eat old people's medicine.
And then they eat the old people.
Yeah. And that's why you have old Liberty Insurance.
So is this something that, like, anybody can do? I mean, can you take some computer, put some Dragon natural speaking software, and, you know, make your home, you know, Dell or Gateway computer answer questions on Jeopardy?
I don't think so.
Could Nick's house be a contestant on Jeopardy once it's finished with its automation update?
I don't think it'll be able to unless we can find the right software developer.
Let's take this conversation offline.
You have to – there's got to be a massive database behind this because it doesn't know the questions that it's going to come at that are going to – you know, it's going to be asked. So you almost have to have a very quick search engine, you know, to a degree that as soon as it hears it, it can search catalogs and extremely quick find the answer to respond to that.
Ross, you were watching a video about some of the background because, you know, in this Wall Street Journal article we're seeing, it was stuffed with millions of documents. It was stuffed with, where did I just lost my train of thought, dictionaries, anthologies, and the World Book Encyclopedia. What did they say kind of about the algorithm and whatnot?
Well, the algorithm is one where Watson first, I mean, it blows my mind the processes you have to go through just to produce an answer in this setting, right? So the machine is paying attention to verbal output from Alex Trebek and from the other people to identify a question out of a human language context, a question which it can then turn into some kind of indexable search process in its data system. Once it performs that search, to Russ's point, you know, it's an enormous database, but once that search is performed, Watson has this sort of confidence value in its answer. And only after it crosses a certain threshold of confidence in the right answer will it actually hit the Jeopardy buzzer and report the answer. So if Watson is not confident enough in the answer, it won't speak up. And that tells me that this database has to have redundant information in it all over the place. How else can you say, you know, I'm confident more or less in the validity of an answer? That means that you're finding evidence of the answer being correct in your data system here and then another place and another place. And that all funnels up to at some point where Watson says, okay, I've found enough instances of the answer that I think I'm looking for, so I'm going to go ahead and report that. It just that whole qualitative search and establishment process blows my mind. I have no idea how that would work.
We're definitely getting closer to that. I was watching, there's a show on the History Channel that I've been watching called Decoded. Very interesting show, but they were talking about this computer that was created where it essentially goes out and is searching the internet constantly. And it looks at what it considers keywords. And it could even be the as a keyword. But it starts actually comparing all of the words that it finds to create predictions of things that are events or things that are going to happen based on those. And so far, I guess, this computer through trial has different things that have happened worldwide politically that have been correct. And they're showing that the algorithm that they're actually using for this is capable of doing predictions, which is kind of, you know, somewhat in the same basis here of being able to search all this data and know that it's got the correct answer. I find that this technology that we're starting to see in the smart by using all this data that's been being put on the internet is now actually being utilized in a different way.
That is intriguing. It sounds as though the computer doing that constant search is answering an open-ended question, in a sense, right? Where it's impressive enough that Watson is able to take a human semantic question and turn it into something you can search a database for, such as, like, you know, who won the World Series in, you know, XYZ year. It's very different to say, what's going to happen next? And then has set a machine loose and say, you know, it's going to have to come to some kind of closed answer to a very open-ended question. That's, again, terrifying.
It's interesting when you think of trying to incorporate humor, idioms, the difference between, like, running a race and running a political race, like, those different things. I mean, trying to program a computer to figure out those differences that are so easy for, you know, humans to do that, is again, a very interesting thing to think about.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, moving on.
Just got Wikipedia, it's got all the answers.
We gotta just kind of download that, yeah.
That's all it is. Watson is just a big download of Wikipedia. That's all it is.
So in your journalism classes, what did they say about Wikipedia?
Did you unmute me? Oh, you did. they didn't say anything about Wikipedia because I went to journalism school back when nobody liked the internet.
Oh, okay.
So
can you reference Wikipedia now at the Free Press? Not that you work at the Free Press anymore or ever did.
Wikipedia is full of a bunch of people who... I'm about to say what I shouldn't say. Wikipedia is like a more professional Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, boy.
There are wiki masters and people who don't ever leave their homes and don't like you and want to make you feel bad because you don't know the rules.
You navigate to the main page of Azeroth when you are confronted by a content administrator. Roll for initiative.
As someone who's been banned from Wikipedia for trying to post about her own group on Wikipedia, that would be Handmaid Detroit, and it was considered advertising.
Yeah, I haven't figured that out because i3 Detroit still isn't on there.
Yeah, well, no, I got banned from it, and I was told to like apologize mildly porn-esque to the wiki master. I wanted nothing to do with that. Y'all can find me on Google. Come on now. Look at...
No, I thought i3 Detroit actually was on the Hackerspaces wiki page.
But are we on, you know, the real wiki page?
No.
I mean, I feel like Reading Rainbow said it best. Y'all, take a look. It's in a book.
Oh, God.
So where LeVar Burton on Twitter is really pissed right now.
LeVar Burton's the man. All right.
Are we talking about glitter?
Okay, we're losing steam. Chicka 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 chicka. Cracking your personal hardware. There have been two stories that have recently come up. One recently is, you know, for a long time people have been cracking iPhones. There was, you know, supposedly that court case that said it was legal, and now it seems like AT&T, as hackers get deeper and deeper and deeper into the code and are finding more and more, it sounds like AT&T is just slightly being pushing back now. And currently, if you have the most recent crack, you actually can't view iBooks. You're getting an error.
I thought I read it's only DRM.
Ah, okay.
iBooks. So if they're, you know, open, then you don't have that problem. But anything that's DRM, you do have that problem.
So what are our thoughts on that? Because, you know, we know a lot of people who have cracked iPhones. You know, in theory, it's legal. Do we see this as something that is necessary and within AT&T's rights to do so?
I think that's it's an interesting question because I'm one of the individuals that I believe if I buy a device, I own the device. And if I want to, you know, hack it to do something different with it than it was intended to, I should have that right. But where it gets interesting is it was passed that it's okay to jailbreak, that it's not violating any copyright law. But at the same time, we can do that, but Apple's saying, okay, but our software that resides on there, such as an iBook app, and the iBooks that you would purchase from us, we have the right to block that if you're running a jailbroke iOS. So I think what we're going to see is companies like Apple getting more creative with how they combat it to try to push people away from doing it.
Yeah, that creativity and how they push back makes a big difference for me because I guess I don't have a particular stance on whether it's like good or bad that Apple takes these types of measures against people who want to break in and manage the software however they want to. But I do see it as it could be a hell of a big nuisance, you know, whether or not they have right to or not. If they make it very painful for me to do something that I want to do with this device, then they're really encouraging me to consider alternatives, you know, especially with the rise of Android as a very substantial competitor to iPhone. You know, I've thought several times, oh, man, it would be great. Maybe I should jump ship. And if I find myself exploring with a jailbroken iPhone and it's just making my life hell, that's only going to encourage me to switch. So I think of it more from an economic perspective. it's you're punishing people in the sense who are obeying your system, or the people who break the system get punished even worse, when you could just switch to a totally different device like an Android and say, hey, oh wow, look, all so much of this is really open and I don't need to worry about any of that stuff.
So all four of us are go ahead.
Okay, or we start seeing more, or you know, like the Android platform being pushed back in some format, to where even if you start jumping platforms, you start seeing the problems. I think what they're doing now is trying to give the end user, they're kind of pushing you. You have to weigh the good and the bad. So do I get more benefits out of having a jailbroke phone, or is it causing too many problems that I get more benefits out of just using the regular iOS? And I think we're going to see companies actually pushing back on that. I don't necessarily agree with it, because I think we should have the right to modify our device once we've purchased that device.
So all four of us are iPhone users. I'm not that familiar with Android. Is it? Do you have to crack an Android, or do you? Could you have access to everything pretty much from the start?
I guess I did misspeak there. Yes, you. I'm confident. Again, owning an iPhone, I'm not totally sure, but I'm confident you do have to actually jailbreak an iPhone's OS if you want to, you know, get really trippy with it. Right now, you can, and like an iPhone, you can build and upload software to your Android, you know, but in order to get to the OS level type crack we're talking about, yes, you do have to sort of get around to the firmware and do things that the phone distributors really don't like you to do.
On the Android.
To Russ's point, yeah, I think you really do need to, you own this device, right? But I can also see from the company's perspective that, you know, they would sweat bullets if a jailbroken device suddenly means a lot of vulnerabilities and, you know, the potential to ruin relations that they have with some of their content distributors and vendors, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, the licensing, you know, stuff we've put in place is null and void. But again, that's sort of a domino effect where you say maybe the licensing practices are bunk as well, because, you know, DRM is obviously not the cat's pajamas.
Well, so let's look at a couple other pieces of consumer software or hardware. PlayStations have, you know, long been something that people have cracked. I think I cracked my first one, you know, back way in PS1. But now with PS3 and having a very substantial piece of hardware, Sony is pushing back now, saying that if you do crack your PlayStation, are running unauthorized or pirated software, this is from PC World, and you will be actually be blocked from your access to PlayStation Network as well as Curiosity, their movie and music, I've never heard of that, download service, permanently. What do we think of this? You know, this has not been deemed legal by judges. Should Sony be doing this?
Well, it's the day-old question, I guess, of what do you really own when you buy a device? You know, I paid for that PlayStation 3, but they're trying to say that I can't do what I want with it. And I think there's two different levels. Is one of the problems is that when you jailbreak an iPhone or a PlayStation, they automatically assume you're doing it for illegal reasons, you know, stealing copyrighted material. Not everyone does it for those reasons. I mean, I look at, going back to the iPhone kind of on this is, if you jailbreak the iPhone, you can run the Cydia app, which allows you access to software that programmers have written. Doesn't mean they're bad software. Maybe for some reason they don't get passed through Apple's restrictions and process to get it on the App Store. Or people don't want to go that route because they want their software to kind of be more open and free, and it does some things that Apple doesn't want it to. I think the same, there's a lot of hackers or people that modify a device for one, educational reasons, or purely for their own, you know, hacking enjoyment. I want to learn and understand this device. So people can do that on a PlayStation 3, and they found out how to do that now because of their flaw. But I don't think it personally gives the right to the manufacturer to deem that wrong and start blocking. But unfortunately, I think this goes back to what we were talking about with the iPhone, that this is the only way they know how to combat it.
You know, I wonder if it's more of a software question because, you know, personally, I think as Sony, if people were using my hardware, to do things that were unattended, that might not be as bad. But maybe going into my software, you know, breaks some kind of agreements. You know, if you look at something like World of Warcraft, people wouldn't necessarily go in there and rewrite the code because they'd be kicked out for cheating, taking advantage of the world. I mean, I've known people that have run their own servers and, you know, they get booted forever. So, you know, maybe it's actually Sony saying, no, you can't edit their software, but, you know, maybe we don't have a problem with you editing the hardware. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting, you know, line of what's right and what's wrong. I think, you know, and maybe it's just my philosophy, but I look at it and say, if Apple looks at the jailbreak community or PlayStation, you know, if there's something that people are doing that you're finding you can learn from, maybe, you know, and if I was a manufacturer, that's, I think, how I want to say I would approach it, saying, watch what these people are doing. They're letting you know as a manufacturer essentially what do they want. If you can find some common traits why people are doing things with the device, it's because you probably don't already provide that service or capability. And so I just look at it as a way to do research and find out what the consumer wants so I can continue to provide better updates, better products to sell more to our to my consumers.
See, that resonates with me a lot, Russ. I like this one. It comes, you know, should the manufacturer, that should they not? You know, that comes to a level where, to me, it's like, is this an ethical question? To me, it's much more pragmatical. It's how do you want your consumers to respond? What sort of behavior are you steering them toward and away from? And, you know, from the manufacturer's perspective, will certain behaviors, like, endanger the relationships that I have with the people providing my software? You know, if I can't guarantee that it won't be, you know, ripped off or something, then obviously they're not going to be interested in doing business with me. So it's very ethical in my mind about making people choose to not jailbreak their phone because, or their PlayStation, because there are all these negative consequences to it. And I just sort of see that as sucky. And, you know, you kind of have to be on the level with your competitors who are choosing to also do the same thing, because if one of them doesn't give you those negative consequences, odds are people are going to sort of shift their preferences toward them. Again, it's a pragmatic consequence. You make these choices to punish your consumers for certain behavior at the behest of your, you know, consumers. But if you can actually learn something from that behavior, right? So if you can say, not, well, users should or shouldn't be doing these things, but you just look at what they're doing and you can figure out a model around that and say, oh, well, we can provide this to our users in this fashion, and then they can subscribe to it or buy it, then you'll come out the winner. You know, you'll be learning from what your consumers are telling you, in a sense.
And for me, that's what I don't know. That's what I wish the manufacturers would do. Because I think they do miss out. They're so worried about protecting, and I realize there's rights, you know, that they have to worry about, like you said, Ross, with other manufacturers, partnerships they have. But I think they can learn a lot, and it's kind of putting it out there to the consumers to say, let us know what you want. Because usually if someone's hacking or modifying a device, it's because they want more out of it than you're providing them. So I think there can be a ton of value for a company there if they really pay attention and watch what, you know, the users are wanting. And I feel like it's an underutilized tool. It's always looked at as, or deemed as, a negative connotation versus what's the positive. Kind of like a lot of corporations these days use social media to reach out to the consumers, to find out more, to be better in touch with the consumer. I think the same goes with hardware hacking. There's a reason why people are doing it, and you should take as a company the time to understand why.
Right, and I agree with you that it's the perspectives on hardware hacking that are so polarized, you know, the viewpoints are so extreme one way or the other, that it tends to, the subtlety of what you can actually learn from all of that gets lost in the shuffle.
I would agree.
All right. For those of you that follow the, I believe it's the Video Game Action Network, they send out some emails every once in a while kind of telling you the legal skinny that's happening in D.C. around the video game industry. And one thing that they had brought up, I'm reading an article from GameStop right now, is that there's a group putting together what's called the E-Tech Caucus, Congressional Caucus for Competitiveness and Entertainment Technology. So what this sounds like is it's actually kind of a lobbying group to promote, educate policymakers and the public about economic, educational, and social benefits of sustaining a robust entertainment software industry. basically kind of pushing the government, saying that video games have value in kind of our current culture, and that they also have some benefit to the public. You know, all of us are video game players. What are our thoughts on this?
I love it. I absolutely love it. I mean, the fact that games pull in as an industry more than movies, and that, you know, there's so much that we do with American work and American creative talent and American writing and programming here to produce video games. To me, it's like, yes, absolutely, gung-ho. I'm all about it. And it's something that I come back to frequently in my own line of work. I don't do video games, but I do interactive advertising. So, you know, boo hiss, I'm a Flash developer. But I'm finding so few people in my community that I can reach out to and say, hey, you know, are you a Flash developer? Come work with me, you know, work at my workplace. I'm finding I'm holding on to jobs, like one or two like positions at my current company, where I can't give these things away. I cannot find people who understand the value of learning this technology for interactive online experiences, who want to jump on board and, you know, just take this job. Talk about economic growth that's just waiting to happen, right? And I imagine that there's that opportunity with video games as well, with this whole industry around creating this type of entertainment. I love it.
You know, it's actually funny because I come from the advertising side of that. Actually, my group would be hiring people like Ross to build these things. And it's very expensive to produce these things, I think partially because there's not the trained people that are doing this. So there's not that competitive nature to have a lot of people fighting over those positions.
Yeah, yeah, especially in the market that you and I are in. It's very saturated right now. Finding people is very tough.
And it's interesting to me, you know, Ross, you spoke primarily about Flash there, that it's such a small market of skilled developers in that arena. You know, I'm in the home automation industry, and it's interesting because we're seeing a big trend now with our software development for automation packages for our touch panel interfaces. All the companies are moving into a Flash development platform.
Really?
And it's interesting is, you know, you take a company, Crestron Electronics, which is one of the largest automation manufacturers, and this year they're releasing a whole new software update, and everything's moving over to Flash development. Control 4 manufacturer has released, they use all Flash interface for all of their touch panels currently, and they just released an app store similar to the Apple's, you know, for automation products. And all of it's developed on Flash, so a developer can go out and develop an application that can be sold or freely given in their app store to be used. So it's interesting that we're seeing this move from Flash into, well, an actual media, human interaction, you know, product line. But we have looked for developers to help develop applications or customize these things, and we've struggled to find them. They're almost non-existent. You can find a few here and there, but I find it interesting how small that marketplace is.
Yeah, overwhelmingly you're going to find that those people are very settled and happy with them because they're employers. They want to keep them. You know, they know how they are to find. And that's that comes back to this original topic about this legislation or this caucus about video game jobs. And there are two things that I really want to highlight about it. And first, it's so refreshing that it's not about video games causing our children to be violent, and it's not about causing them to, you know, listen to crazy rap music and go out with guns and kids these days. You know, it's such a different tone, you know, that we're hearing. And I that very much. And in the second place, there is this really important thing about Flash, again, coming back to that as the example, but I think it also applies to video games, which is that there's no really strong academic curriculum for teaching this technology, right? The economic growth in this sector, right, to say, you know, interactive advertising and internet technology in general has just grown so explosively rapidly that most places that you'll go to get an education are not going to offer up-to-date training on how to become one of these people ready for one of these jobs, right? People going to school right now, they're going to have jobs when they graduate that don't exist today. It just, the technology grows at such a pace that these things don't keep up. And I'm sure that's the case also with video games, right? Video game technology being innovated and expanded upon, you know, year over year by these major companies like Microsoft and Sony.
It's funny because I went to school, to college, 2000 to 2004, and I took all of the interactive advertising classes that we could, because my degree was advertising. Mm-hmm. And the flash that I learned was stuff that I could have picked up on the internet in about 10 seconds. I remember making silly little flash banners that were completely worthless, back in the day. And it's, again, the technology leap, changed overnight. Flash advertising happened in a couple of years, just people gaining that and using it more and more. So it is interesting that has been adapted so fast. And, now we're looking at Ajax and, some of the more advanced technologies that are bringing in all these different live databases and live feeds and RSS and all of that mm-hmm. I don't know if kids are learning, in schools right now. I really, really hope they are.
Oh God. When kids have even a baseline interest in programming period, then I'm encouraged, let alone any of this really advanced stuff. I mean, if you want to be on the cutting edge in this world now, you've got to be up on your Facebook integration API, your Twitter integration API, your YouTube. I mean, now it's getting to the point where you need to know all of these peripheral languages just to get to the point where you can tie together these huge web services to create a product that spans all of them, to integrate all these different social media channels. That's kind of the challenge that I face in my workplace. That's so far ahead of what gets taught in schools and what gets taught in these programs. You're exactly right, Nick. I mean, most of the things you can learn in an interactive type program, whether that be video games or for advertising, it's just baseline, or it's going to be ancient history by the time you're out of the job market. The fact that there is this type of attention being paid to video as an industry, that's very encouraging to me, because there's attention being paid to that fact and getting people into a marketplace, right? So advocating for the jobs and the learning that makes those jobs possible.
Well, you mentioned, Ross, that, the size of the market already with the gaming, and I think we're about to go through another level of explosion in the gaming industry. And a lot of that is, I think, going to be driven by the 3D market. The 3D, televisions, the 3D market in the home video world isn't doing as well as they hoped. And I think that, for me, it's kind of obvious in the aspect of, well, who always wants to watch TV with their glasses on? Kind of got an amusement aspect to it. But where I think 3D technology in the home is really going to take off is if it starts being utilized for the video game. What a better way to immerse yourself even further into the game. So I really do think that we're going to have a whole new level of developers, and we're going to see this next big boom where the kids do need to be taught how to do that. Unfortunately, I think there are a handful of schools out there that are teaching some of these things, maybe on different levels or not exactly video game programming. But one example is my dad actually works for the school system, and I listen to him talk about the tech that they have at the school, and it blows me away. And this is a high school, just completely blows me away compared to back when we were in school. But they actually, Cisco has put together a group of classes within the school for the kids, where kids can come out of high school fully Cisco certified with all of their different CCNAs, certifications. And it's quite amazing to watch these kids that are coming out of these high school programs that already have these level of skills, even in the networking world. But
that's incredible.
that's not mass produced in getting to enough kids.
Yeah, that highlights a problem I see in general with people having an interest in computer science, I guess. I mean, being a programmer, of course, programming is very close to my heart, not just as a trade, but as something that I love to do with my time. And, it's part of my life, right? And I get the strong feeling that not many, maybe this is just me becoming a crotchety old man, but I get the feeling not many kids going through high school these days, or, the up and comers, you might call it, have that kind of interest in computer science or in programming or how all this technology works. But it's going to be so core, only going to become more essential as time goes on. So the fact that, a kid can graduate from high school with his CCNA and all of his certification is amazing, but I agree with you, that's probably not the typical case.
Correct.
Well, the last story I have before we quickly run out of tape is I have a thing here that Pandora is actually going to go public. They just filed their S-1 registration on Friday, and they're going to start doing their initial common stock offering to try to raise $100 million. This is being reported by TheStreet.com. I think it's really cool to see that Pandora has gone from this little kind of internet baby to something that is being used by everyone and their brother, and is now, even as kind of Russ tells me, that even all the bigwigs in their big mansions are using, that Pandora has really infiltrated the public, and it's becoming something that people use constantly all throughout the day.
I think it's awesome. You know, personally, I look at it compared to something like Groupon. You look how well Groupon does. I think Pandora personally offers way more value, in my opinion. So I really hope they succeed at this, because I think it's going to bring a lot of positive things. I think this aspect of free music, you know, via ad sharing, is definitely the way to go, and also help bring down possible, you know, theft of music, and kind of take the, you know, take a shift. And we're seeing it integrated into, you know, every Blu-ray player that comes out nowadays has Pandora in it. You've got apps for all the devices nowadays. It's becoming more and more a growing thing. It's interesting, because in the automation industry, every client's asking for it to be a part of their home automation system. They want it for their multi-zone audio.
Unfortunately, we had to cut our conversation about Pandora short, but I did want to get Russ's thoughts in there about the automation industry making such a big demand on what began as a startup project on the internet. It's amazing to see this sort of technology progress. Thanks to Nick Britsky for hosting this week. Thanks also to Russ Wolf and Lish Dorset for offering their brains for the picking. I noticed a few times Lish tried to edge glitter into the conversation, somewhere between robots and video games. Next time, we do need a couple topics in the vein of crafting and the arts, but with sci-fi wet dreams like Watson and RoboCop on the table, it's all too clear where the boys will steer the conversation. I hope you can forgive us. What you just heard was the i3 Detroit Hour. If you have comments or questions about our program, please don't hesitate to reach out. We are very open to ideas and criticisms from our audience, and want to give you more content you are interested in hearing. You can email us at contact@i3detroit.com. All music we use in our program was found online under the Creative Commons license. To learn more about the music, please email us at contact@i3detroit.com. Thank you for listening.